Welcome to the Building Stories podcast series. My name is Amy Barnes, and I'll be your host as we explore some of Ontario's built heritage. This series will include 15 podcasts in total, so if you enjoyed today's show, be sure to check out some of the others. The podcast will include a brief history of the building, interviews with people who have some connection to this space, but the ultimate goal is to try and tell stories about the buildings, stories about the space that most people don't know. So without further ado, let's get started on today's topic. Today we are going to dive right into a fascinating story as we head to Camp 30 in Bowmanville, Ontario. Not only does this site tell part of the local history, but it speaks to a chapter of our national history, and anyone who has an interest in military history has probably heard of Camp 30, since it was used as a prisoner of war camp, housing up to 800 prisoners during the Second World War. Although Camp 30 is associated with its years as a POW camp, the history of the site before and after those years are equally as interesting. I had the pleasure of speaking with Martha Rutherford Conrad, who quite possibly knows more about the site's history than anyone else out there. So I'm going to let her do a lot of the talking during this podcast because she's very informative and very passionate about the subject. Martha became aware of Camp 30 when she became the executive director of the Clarington Museum and Archives in 2002. Now at this time it was a private facility and therefore the public didn't have a lot of access to it, but she always kept her eye on what was happening to it. Around 2009, the site changed hands and came under the ownership of a housing developer who approached the museum to learn more about the history. Martha became engrossed in the stories and the information she uncovered, and she ended up putting a lot of her own personal time into doing primary research. After realizing the extent of this national treasure at their doorstep, she started working with local citizens, putting forth an application to make it a national historic site. I asked Martha to tell me about the history of the site, and because she knows so much about the space, she was able to do so with great detail. Now, when I spoke to Martha, she was calling from Alberta, and we were talking on a cell phone, so there's the odd spot where the audio goes a bit wonky, but they're far and few between and certainly don't detract from this amazing story. So here we go.
So it actually started as a farm, as a family farm. It was called the Darch Family Farm. And that farm was purchased by a local Bowmanville resident, John H.H. Jury. And he was he owned pharmacies. He was a fairly wealthy local citizen. In 1922, he actually traveled into Toronto to listen to a presentation that was being given by the then mayor of Toronto, J. Alex Edmondson. And Edmondson is well known in Canadian history for papers and theories and concepts that he wrote around the juvenile delinquency and what to do with young people that got into trouble. And he believed quite strongly that young people in trouble were in trouble due to circumstances beyond their control, and that we needed to take a gentler approach with them and provide them with an opportunity to change the course of their life. And he was proposing this concept of training schools. So when these young kids were picked up off the street, he was saying, we need to send them to training schools, and the training schools need to be not like prisons, but like private schools where they're open and they're warm and they're welcoming, and these young boys, in particular at this time, would have an opportunity to get an education, to function within a family unit, and to become good contributing members of society. So he was talking about that concept in Toronto, and Mr. Jury was there listening, and he was very intrigued and engaged with the concept. And following the presentation by Edmondson, he went up to him and said, if you're serious about this, I would like to donate my farm to the cause. And so the Darch Farm actually became the Bowmanville Boys Training School in 1925, and it was the first one in the province. It was built, the provincial built it. They built it to highest building standards at the time, so they used steel I-beams. They used a form of architecture that's very rare even today in public buildings, and it's called a prairie-style architecture. And it functioned for many years, 1925 through 1979, as a training school. And it was its own entity. So they produced their own power. They had their own water source. They grew all of their own food. And it really spoke to this whole self-sustainability movement that's going on. And so it's always sort of functioned in that capability. After 1979, the provincial government had changed its its beliefs around the juvenile delinquency movement. And they did that primarily because the young people that were juvenile delinquents were becoming a little bit more hardcore than the early cases, and they found that they had to move more towards a group home concept, a smaller concept, and they actually did need a little bit more containment for these boys. And there were actually girls that the boys training in the training school at that time as well too. So they decided to close the school, and it was sold. After that, it continued to operate as a school until 2009, I believe it was, where the last school actually shut down and left. They actually went bankrupt and left, and then the housing developer took over the site. Now, in that entire history, there was that few years, 4 years, during World War II, where the site was seconded by the federal government for use as a POW camp. And that is where the name Camp 30 comes from. And they came in, they were interested in the site because it was a self-contained unit, because it had its own power, it had its own water, and they were able to very quickly come in and convert this to a POW camp. The boys were moved out into other training schools, and then from 1941 to 1945, it operated as Camp 30, a POW camp.
Now that you know a bit more about the story of the site, you might be disappointed to know that since its abandonment, it has suffered greatly at the hand of neglect, vandalism, and fires. As we speak, though, there is a growing movement of dedicated volunteers and concerned citizens who are working at the local, provincial, and national levels to get some kind of protection for the site. As of April 19, 2013, the federal government accepted the application for formal recognition as a National Historic Site that Martha had been working on for some time. It is not only the 4 years it was a POW camp that makes this story of national significance. It is the fact that this is the last remaining intact POW camp in Canada. Now, a National Historic designation is an excellent first step, but what many people don't realize is that this is a commemorative designation, and it carries with it no legal protection whatsoever. But what this designation has done is generate attention and recognition for the site, and Martha hopes that the momentum will grow from this and a solution found in order to breathe new life into the space. Since Martha knew the history intimately, I asked her if she could relay any interesting stories about its time as a POW camp or any significant events that took place. She had a lot to offer, so here we go.
The Camp 30 is actually famous within the POW community as housing the highest-ranking German POWs captured during the war. From 1941 to 1945, there were actually three German generals that were housed in the site. One of the generals, General von Ravenstein, is a very interesting man. It's actually, I have seen mentioned that he was actually involved with the Valkyrie plot to assassinate Hitler. He was a professional soldier, and he believed quite strongly in making sure that the German soldiers that were housed in the camp looked to the future beyond the war. So while he was there, he actually collaborated with the University of Toronto to have professors come in and continue to educate the POWs. He talked to them all the time about you need to continue to grow your skills because at some point this war is going to end. At some point you're going to be going home, and you have to find how you're going to continue to make a living or contribute to German society and help rebuild our country when the war is over. So he was a very interesting man. Otto Kretschmer, the commander of U-Boat 99, was also housed within Camp 30. And Otto Kretschmer, once again, he was a professional sailor. He was actually infamous for having sunk the highest number of Allied ships during World War II, and he held that record throughout the whole war. He was actually captured in 1941, and by that time, he'd already set the record for the most Allied ship sinkings, and no other U-boat commander for the remaining period of the war actually broke his record. And he actually went on, he received the highest decorations from NATO for his contributions in the Navy world, so following World War II. So, you know, he was an incredibly important person within that world. What is important to distinguish, and often people sort of fall into this trap, is making the assumption, and it's understandable because certainly the propaganda from World War II spoke in this manner as well, is that these men were not Nazis. There were no known Nazis housed at Camp 30. Any known Nazis were actually sent to the, there was two German POW camp, two POW camps in Alberta, and the known Nazis were actually sent out to those camps. So what you typically found in Camp 30 were professional soldiers, airmen, Navy men, and enlisted Germans. There were some very significant events that happened in Camp 30 from 1941 to 1945. Perhaps one of the most significant is the Battle of Bowmanville. Following the raid in Dieppe, and then there was also a raid on an island off the coast of Britain, Germans actually found some of their men had been shackled, and that's against the Geneva Convention, and they were outraged about that. And so they started shackling Allied prisoners in their camps in Europe. Churchill was very upset about this, and he actually sent orders through to Canada, and in particular to Camp 30, because that, keep in mind, that's where the highest-ranking Germans were housed, so he wanted to have a significant impact, and he said that he wanted the German POW shackled within the camps. Now, there was correspondence that went back and forth between Canada and Britain over this, because the Canadians initially did not want to do this. The commander of the camp announced it to the POWs in camp that they would be shackled, and the POWs held a vote as to whether or not they would comply with the order, and decided not to, and they barricaded themselves in the buildings around the camp. So they actually sent in reinforcements from the unit. And they arrived by train to Bowmanville, and the commander, the commandant of the camp, actually, as these additional soldiers got off the train, he actually took their guns from them and gave them baseball bats because he wanted it to be a fair fight. The Battle of Bowmanville raged for 3 days. There were injuries, broken bones, like the type of injuries you see from baseball bats and jars and rocks and sticks. And it raged for 3 days. They actually set up a hospital in the camp to handle all of the injured, and it was neutral territory. Canadians and Germans were all handled in the hospital. And the last building to fall was the cafeteria building, and the Canadians actually held in through the upper story windows of the cafeteria building to rout the German POWs that had barricaded themselves in that building.
I will end today's podcast by letting Martha explain why this place should matter to all Canadians.
It is very Canadian. It's very representative of what it is to be a Canadian. I've had the privilege of speaking to some of the actual POWs that were housed in Camp 30. They talk about how they were treated very fairly. They were treated very humanely. Canada was very, very careful to be aware of the Geneva Convention and to make sure that they were following it. They had medical aid. They made sure that their letters got out. Their uniforms, part of the Geneva Convention is when you're captured, you're entitled to your rank and uniform in your POW camp, wherever that may be. We see in our archives many pictures of these POWs, and they were all in their uniforms with their medals. Now, they would tell you, and they did tell me, you know, they were still in a prison, and they were very, very aware of the fact that they were in prison, and they would have much rather been with their families. But while they were there, they were treated very fairly, and they were treated very humanely. And I tell people that I talk to about it is that there's no shame in that. There should be pride in that, and the fact that Canada followed the Geneva Convention and took care with its POWs to give them to make sure that they were treated fairly and that they had a chance beyond this war to go on and live their lives to their fullest. And to me, I have a great pride in that, and I'm really, really glad that Camp 30 actually tells that story, even just as an example to maybe other countries in the world that we know did not treat their POWs well at all.
I would like to thank Martha Rutherford Conrad for taking the time to speak with me about Camp 30. If you want to learn more about the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario and its involvement with the preservation and conservation of buildings all over Ontario, the ACO is celebrating its 80th anniversary by putting together a book. This book will feature 80 buildings the organization has had a hand in saving over the last 80 years. Now, the Building Stories episode you heard today is just one that will be included, but there are many more stories to discover. You can get the book starting in November 2013 by ordering it online at their website. The Building Stories podcast series could not have been made possible without our sponsors, so a big thank you to the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario, the Heritage Resource Centre at the University of Waterloo, the Center for Community Mapping, the Computer Systems Group at the University of Waterloo, and the Government of Ontario. If you have any comments, we would love to hear from you. You can email the Building Stories team at info@buildingstories.co or send them a tweet at Building Stories, which is BLDG_stories. And of course, you can find them on Facebook under the Building Stories Facebook page. These podcasts have been written, produced, and hosted by myself, Amy Barnes, and I'd like to take this last moment to thank you all for listening.